Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Bhūtaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. So Saturday, Lumpur gave a Dhamma talk, and he mentioned that the topic he was going to speak on was something that he'd been reflecting on sort of, you know, most of the week, and so I'm going to do the same thing. And Ajahn Yaniko mentioned last week that the community's kind of been in a less of a work environment, and two groups went to Yosemite. And I've told most people here just a little, you know, brief bit of the account of the first group's trip. And we're kind of holding back on some of the details because I wanted to give a Dhamma talk. I needed material, so I had to be quiet about a lot of what happened. It was, I think I've heard from the second group too, from several people that he's had a really, you know, very harmonious time, you know, really good time for developing friendships in a slightly different way. Just people, you know, a little bit sort of setting down a little bit of the hierarchy or the structure of the monastery. In some ways, the trip is really a nice way of, you know, I was talking about this last night at Three Jewels that, you know, living in a monastery can be a very safe place because everything's structured. You know what time you're supposed to get up. You know what time you have to be there for puja. Someone tells you what you're cooking that day for the meal. Someone tells you what work you're doing. You know, it's all very, say, regimented. And there can be a real freedom in that. And that's partly why we do it. It gives us the opportunity to, you know, get into doubt, or we can in those sort of situations. But it gives you the structure for how to be in a more relaxed atmosphere. Actually, a lot of people think of, you know, living in a monastery as being tense and a lot of rules and restricting, but it can actually be just the opposite if you have the right attitude. So going to Yosemite is actually just the opposite. It's like you see, most people are like, oh, great, freedom. We get to get out into the country and we can finally relax. But in some ways, it's like we still have all the same rules. But you know, there isn't someone telling you you have to be up at this time, or you have to meditate at this time, or we're doing this chanting. It's up for us to bring in the practice, you know, what we've learned in the monastery, you know, how to be harmonious, how to not know exactly. You know, it's like all the food is sort of, you know, presented, whatever the lay people on the trip want to offer to us, and you know, you have to decide how you're going to make that into a meal. It's not someone cooking it for you. And so it's a really interesting way of, you know, taking the training that we've done here and putting it into a new situation. And then, you know, most of the time it's while we're there, it's for, you know, people to hike, explore, spend time meditating, or just being in nature. And so I've been fortunate. I think this is the fourth year in a row I've gone, and it seems like every year I go, my health is getting better and better, and being kind of willing or wanting to get out and explore a little bit more. And so where we camp is right on the edge of Yosemite National Park. It's in Inyo National Park, and it's kind of a big valley. And if you just go about a mile or two from our campsite in a particular place, you can stand and you're completely surrounded by peaks. You know, it's like you're completely in the middle of the wilderness and you can't see any structures. And 4 years ago when I was there, most of those peaks were snow-covered, and they weren't this year. So you're really out in the middle of it's called the High Sierras. You know, it's like 12,000-foot peaks all around you. But in the very back, if you go about 2 or 3 miles back into this valley, there's it's about a 3 mile wide or long wall. It's about a 1,000-foot cliff, and it's overhanging in places. So it actually kind of, when you get back and you're looking at it, it almost looks like this tidal wave is going to, you know, crush you. And say it's about 3 miles long, and on the top of it is that particular ridge is Mount Kness. And last year, a group went up with a guide, and the person who actually invited us to start doing this trip, a man named Robert, and he took the group up and showed them a route up there. So over the 4 years that I've been there, I've always been intrigued by it and wanted to kind of find a way up. And every year I take a map and study it and go out. And there's this one place in particular that's kind of intriguing, a way to get up is to find Alpine Lake. And twice I've gone up to find Alpine Lake and couldn't even find Alpine Lake. It was just sort of missing it just slightly. And then this year, one of the person that did the trip last year was on our trip, and then so he took me up to Alpine Lake, and then that I got a complete sense of where kind of things were at that point. And then this community member and I were hiking down, and we decided not to go down the same route. We decided to kind of bushwhack, and it was a really fun experience. It took us a lot longer to go down, and then we heard some people hiking off in the distance, and we kind of saw them finally, and so okay, there must be a trail there, so we were heading in their direction. And then we got to kind of a flat area and stopped for just to catch our breath, get a little bit of water. And this person was sitting there, and they go, "Hey, this is a cairn." And we're sitting right next to a cairn, which is a piling up of rocks. And you do it a lot in, say, northern environments where you're hiking, where you get above tree line or in snow situations. And there's a pile of rocks that if you're standing at one, theoretically you should be able to look in the distance and see the next one. So it gives you a visual of where the trail would be. And as soon as he said that, I looked down and was like, yeah, and that's a trail right at my feet. And so we were relieved, and we followed the trail down. But right before we headed off, I looked to see, you know, which way the trail was going, and it headed up a little bit higher in elevation and went to this flat plateau right at the base of still, you know, further over on this cliff that I'd never actually ever seen or explored. But I just made a mental note of that and then went down. And it was much more hiking than I thought I was going to do on the first day. So the next day I just thought, well, I'll just take an easy day and do some studying for Vinaya class and just do some reading. But about 11 o'clock I was fully energized and ready to go. So I went out that same area and hiked up and set a real clear intention that I was only going to hike till about 2 o'clock, because I knew it was about a 2 or 3 hour hike back, and I just wanted to, you know, not get back too late. And I set a 2 o'clock time limit, and to my surprise, it was a really easy hike, and I just kept hiking, and right at 2 o'clock, I could see the ridge. Actually, if I had an arm, if I was an athlete, I could have thrown a stone over the top. I was that close, and I was looking, and there were like three or four kind of chutes that you could climb up, and I couldn't tell if any of them were doable. Some of them looked really dangerous, but I'd set a 2 o'clock limit, so I decided to honor that and go back. And then one of the other monks who was on the trip with me, we started talking about it. And he's secretly, the last 4 years, has been trying to find a way up to the top of this ridge as well. And as we started talking about it, and we decided that we would do an overnight. We'd take just tarps and our sleeping bags and go up. And because everybody that we saw coming down from this hike looked like they'd been through a war. Everybody looked exhausted when they came down. It's like a round trip, kind of about a 14-mile hike. And so we were like, well, we don't need to do it all in one day. We'll go up. And so the day between, so the third day, both Anagarika, Doug, and Beth generously offered to drive, to do a side trip, which we've never done on this trip, is just go into the valley, Yosemite Valley. So we took a two-hour back trip into the valley, and the joke became that I was looking for a book that I wanted to, you know, kind of look up guidebooks and see if there was any description of how to get up to Kness. And someone told me, said, you know, you're looking for the book called How to Get to the Summit of Kness Without Dying. That's all I want to know, just how to get to there without dying. So that kind of became a joke, and I was able to find a couple of descriptions of the hike and confirmed what I was thinking. So the next day, I actually found out too that you can't overnight camp at that elevation and in that area. So we're like, okay, well, we'll have to do it as a day hike, and then, which wasn't as appealing to either myself or the other monk. But we eventually decided, let's just go ahead and give it a try. There was no intention to actually make it to the summit of Kness, but I wanted just to get above the ridge and see what was up there and hike around. So fortunately, as we started hiking, we started meeting some other people that were doing it. And the first couple we met was somebody staying in the campground, and it sounds like they do it like multiple times every year. Like, and they were very confident, and I described to them the route that I thought I was going to take, and he confirmed it perfectly. I was like, okay, great. And then fortunately, they ended up passing us as we were going out there. So then when we got to the tricky spot, we could actually see two other people climbing up it, and we knew exactly where to go. And as is often the case when you're doing climbing, you're looking at something from a half mile away. It can look quite simple, but then when you get to it, it's another thing. And before I became a monk, I'd been a extremely amateur rock climber. I had some skills and had some training. It did mention on the guidebooks that there was one spot that was the crux of the whole hike, that this particular route we took. And we got to it, and it was kind of described as like a leap of faith is one way to describe it. And the chute itself was, the first part wasn't too steep. It was if you slipped and fell, you might go 20 or 30, 40 feet before you'd stop, but it wasn't that steep. But then you get to about the midpoint, and then it got really, really steep. And the tricky thing about this part was that it was all like even smaller than gravel, like almost like not sand, but almost like ball bearings you're kind of walking on. And there's these smallish kind of boulders, and it's really easy to slip, or you'd be walking and you lose your footing. And so it's quite scary. But then at this critical point, well, actually, for an hour, you've been climbing through sort of a boulder field, and boulders, kind of the size of, like, say, a human being to, the size of a Volkswagen Rabbit kind of car. I mean, just literally for an hour, just, boulder after boulder after boulder. And you get to this critical point, and there's all these kind of boulders that exact same size, same color. Everything's exactly the same as those boulders down below. And you've always realized that the boulders down below actually came from up above. And you're actually climbing, you're actually pulling on these boulders to get above them, you're climbing onto them, and it's like, this is stupid. It's kind of going through your mind, and so you're really being careful. And then at the critical point, I was looking at the rocks, and I was like, that thing isn't really attached to the ground. It's like it's kind of sitting on top of these bolts and all these loose pebbles as well. And but I had to say I had enough skill or confidence in my maybe blind confidence to get over this point. And I'd seen two other couples make it, so I did this climb, got above that point, and then my heart started racing because as soon as I did the move, I kind of looked down and I realized if you fell for the next say 40 foot of the climb, you were going to develop a lot of momentum and you wouldn't fall 30 feet, you'd fall quite a long ways. And so I just scampered up the next 40 feet, and it was really steep. It was almost like going up a ladder, and got to a safe point. And then the monk that I was hiking with, he tried several times to, see if there was a safer way to get over that point, or, tried it. And he just said, "Ajahn, I'm not coming any higher." And I told him, I said, even in that moment, I told him, I said, I'm really impressed with that. That you can see your limits, your boundaries, and don't feel bad about it. That's fine. And I said, but are you okay if I don't come down? And I said, because I am not coming down this. It's easier if you've ever done rock climbing. It's much easier to go uphill than up a climb than it is to go down. So I was actually very frightened. I was like, my heart rate was going and my adrenaline was pumping. And I was just like, yeah, I'm not coming down this route. I'm going to have to find another route to come down. And this monk was like, he didn't have any choice, but he was fine with that. And so then we parted ways. And I talked to him later, actually, last night. I talked a little bit about this at Three Jewels, and I wanted to hear his perspective of the same thing. And we actually both had some sort of sense of abandonment. It's like, I abandoned him, he abandoned me, or I abandoned him, being up there. And that was—it's kind of for me at the time. It was actually kind of emotional because I almost died about 20 years ago in a hike in Nepal, where I was actually abandoned by my hiking companions, and they didn't actually realize, you know, what was happening or what they did. And it was a 3-day ordeal to get back down to this airport where I really did believe that at any moment I could have died. It was like, it was really, really intense altitude sickness. But I survived that one. So it did bring up, you know, emotional sort of quality came up with that. You know, again, it wasn't any blaming, but it was just sort of that was the reality. Or, you know, partly it was like, oh, what, you know, it wasn't, it definitely was nothing, any sense of betrayal or anything like that, but it was a sort of sense of, you've just put, you know, taking personal responsibility for it. I put myself in a bad situation. Like, okay, what have you just done? You got yourself up here, but now you got to find a way down. So the first thing I did was just took assessment. Okay, what's the situation? You know, what do you have? What do you don't have? So fortunately, I had been studying this route, on and off for the last 4 years, and had a pretty good picture in my mind of where the trails were. I'd heard the other group, they took a different trail up, so I had a sense of where they went up. And so I knew that there were other routes down. There were other people up on the mountain, and actually some other people came up while we were there. So in some sense, it's like I'm actually kind of making this sound more dramatic maybe than it was, but it's not how it felt at the time. In sense of sort of being abandoned or not having help, that actually, I actually knew wasn't the case. Like if I really, really got in a bad situation, I could have ask people for help, but ends up not needing it. But my initial reaction was, okay, well, I'm going to walk. I was up there, and the hiking, once you get above the ridge, was actually quite beautiful and pleasant, and so I ended up walking 2.5 miles over to the summit, and actually had no ambition to climb to the summit, but I went over there and looked around, and that's where I thought the trail would be down, and I couldn't find the trail, or the two places that I thought might be the trail looked actually more dangerous than what I just come up. So I was like, it was quite an interesting moment, because it's like what happened is there was this fear of death. You know, there was this fear of, you're going to have to go back to that same chute that I hiked up. And it was quite an interesting moment, because I kind of sat there and was just hoping that something else, some other idea would come into my head, and nothing did. And it was just like, yeah, there had to be this moment of, okay, you've got to go face that. You know, this is you've created the situation. Go, you know, you've got to. You know, you can. Yeah, you know. I knew I could. I knew I could hike down, but it was just the risk of it was you know, to me was you know, right at the edge of my climbing abilities, and one of the guidebooks that I had read was that, in terms of like technicality of climbs, like at a certain point, it's like you really need a rope for, you know, say beginner. You know, there are people that climb El Capitan without ropes nowadays, but you know, for a beginner climber, so if there's a certain level where a rope is really essential. And this hike up was, they said, you couldn't get any more technical where you wouldn't need a rope. So it was this right at the edge of hiking, extreme hiking. And so, yeah, I had to face that to come down. And then actually later about this sort of chute, if you do the summit, there's about a 5 or 6 foot section on the trail as you're coming up where you're really exposed. And it's like a foot or two wide from what I've heard, and about 5 or 6 feet long. And but there's a wall right next to you with a crack that you can sort of hold on to as you go by. The consequences, though, is if you were to fall, if the wind came and knocked you off or something, if you fell from there, it's, you know, 99.999% certain you would die. It's like a 1,000-foot fall from this little tiny little ledge you have to cross. And then this couple, though, that was just in front of us, they were a younger couple, and we had talked to them, and then I saw them at the very end of the hike, and they had seen me hiking alone up on the ridge, so they were actually kind of concerned, like, what happened to your partner, and is everything all right, and all that. So it was really sweet. So, but I asked them, I said, so you did, you know, I saw you up at the summit and you did the chute. I said, which was scarier, that chute or that little 5-foot section you had to cross? And they said, both. Mm-hmm. I said, that little 5 or 6 foot section you had to climb, it was like, if you fell there, you were dead. So that was scary. But he said, I felt no chance in the world that I was going to fall there. He said, it was just walking across the street. He said he had no doubt about it, but he did realize the consequences of it. He said the chute, though, he said he felt like there's a good chance he could fall, but he might get away with just breaking a bone or breaking a leg or if you fell there. So like it was kind of interesting. I had that same, yeah, if you fell, you get some momentum going. But then, obviously, from telling the story, I survived. I made it down. And the one sweet thing I wanted to say about it was the monk that that I hiked up with, it took about 2 hours, maybe a little bit longer, for me to walk over to see if I could find the other trail, and couldn't, and come back. But when I came down, the monk had waited for me. He had waited for a couple hours, and he was about ready to give up, because I told him, I said, I might try to find another way down, but he waited. And partly I think he waited because he realized I didn't have any water. I didn't have some of the gear that you... I actually had enough water for the day. I actually had like 2 water bottles, and it was enough. But you know, he didn't know if I would drink those or need those. And if I came down that way, it was still a two-hour hike from there to get back to the camp, and I would have run out of water. So it was really sweet that he had that mindfulness and care and attention to wait, just out of concern. But then when we got back to the campground, I was curious, and so I pulled out the trail map and started looking, because about the routes and where I actually did I miss the trail or. I noticed on the back, this is the map here that I didn't have, but on the very back of it, there was this list of survival tips for hiking, and it said, be prepared, carry the 10 essentials, so whenever you're out hiking or something like that, anywhere, it's like these, they say these are the 10 things that you should have. So the first one was a map and compass. The second one is sort of material to be able to build a fire in case you get injured or have to stay out. You need some warmth, so like matches, candles, fire starter. Extra water, extra food, a pocket knife, sunglasses, a first aid kit, extra clothing or rain gear, a flashlight, and a repair kit. And I was looking at this list, and I was like, I had the sunglasses. So if I was going to die, I was going to at least look cool, but everything else, I didn't have the map. That was with the other monk. We hadn't thought about matches or candles, or I did have enough water, but not enough if I got stuck up there. I did have extra food. I had a block of cheese because I knew I might be tired on the way down, but I had my lunch and cheese. But everything else, I didn't have. And I also, not only is it kind of bad situation of the hiking, but I was wearing sandals when I went up. And my sandals were about ready to fall apart. And I asked the other monk if we were heading out if he had any kind of a repair kit, and he did. So I was like, okay, great, we're fine. But then as soon as I got to the ridge, I was like, yeah, now if my sandal fall apart, it's like he's got the map, he's got the compass, he's got the water filter, he's got the first aid kit. I was like, bad situation. So, but I had the sunglasses, so I was not too concerned. But so anyway, I started looking at that list, I realized it's like, that is a good list, for safety reasons, or for wilderness. Those are really good tools to have. But actually, it's like none of that actually saved me. None of that actually, got me down off the mountain. So I was like, I wonder what the Buddha would have to say. What would be the Buddha's 10 essentials for, what you'd need to take out there on this hike? And I mean, the first thing that came to my mind was, like as soon as I got up, it was just, mindfulness, just sort of, okay, let's take assessment of what's going on. Like, what do you have? What do you know about the situation? Trying to use a little bit of wisdom, discernment. There were various other options I could have done. One was to, if I couldn't have found a way down, was to go into Yosemite Park itself. But without a map and a compass, I actually hadn't studied that aspect of the map. So like wisdom kicked in and said, no, you could actually get lost in there. And, don't try that one. Or, there were other people there that I probably could have gotten help down from. So didn't necessarily need to go to that extreme yet, or didn't need to go to that route. So I got back and I was looking in the Anguttara Nikaya, which is the book of lists. And so just curiosity, or just make it similar, picked the book of 10 and started looking through, and found it's in the book of 10s, number 8, 17 and 18, which are the protectors the ten protectors. And so the Buddha kind of starts off the sutta with encouraging the monks or anybody who's practicing to have a protector. Someone who doesn't have a protector is it's not so safe. And so he goes through this list of ten. And as I was studying it, looking through it, and been contemplating it this week, especially Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation in the Wisdom Publications in his new book, it really struck me how closely related this list was to the first part of the Metta Sutta. It's almost in some ways it's not so much in the ten qualities themselves, word for word, but how he describes sort of maybe adjectives that describe some of the qualities or how to develop them, how to practice them. Sometimes it's almost like word for word in these qualities of the Metta Sutta. And I just found that really fascinating that was the case. And so that first part of the Metta Sutta is like, this is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace, the path. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm, wise and skillful, and not demanding, and also not doing anything that the wise would later reprove. So the list here, very briefly, that the Buddha goes through, the ten that he listed in this, these protectors, is first one is the monk is virtuous and keeps the virtues in line with whatever precepts that they've undertaken. So for the monks, it's the 227, novices, it's 10. The lay guests who are living here in Angarkas, it's 8, and lay people, just living by the five precepts and, taking an interest in those, and when you do live in a way that's non-harming and skillful, that we can obviously see that there's a protection in doing that. And it's interesting because the very last part of that list of that the Buddha listed, it's like not doing anything that the wise would later reprove, and that ties in completely with virtue. That's the living by our precepts and living in a way that people wouldn't find fault with the way we live. So that, that ties in perfectly with Metta Sutta. The second one is that the person is learned, that they listen to Dhamma, they listen to teachings, and not only do they listen to them, but they reflect on them, they bring them to mind, and their mindfulness is such that they remember these things. So it's the things that were even said long ago that come into their mind, and they can put those into practice. Third one is someone who has a good friends, good companions in our lives. And you can see as a protection, if you do have people that are looking after you, like this monk who stuck around and made sure that if I came back that way, that I was gonna have some water to drink, looking after me that way, or sort of, he could probably sense that when I got to that critical point that I was really scared, and I think I probably told him that, and so he could have said, no, why don't you come down? I don't feel comfortable with you going up there, But I talked to him later, and he did say that he said if he was with probably anybody else, he may have felt like he said he trusted me, the fact that I wouldn't go trying to bushwhack my way through Yosemite, trying to find Tuolumne Meadows. He said that he actually had confidence that I would use discernment and try to think things out. He said if it was somebody he didn't know, he said he may have actually risked that climb because someone could have gotten injured, somebody could have gotten lost, and so he had a little bit more sense of responsibility to in a different situation. So yeah, just having a good friend and singing also with this quality of a good friend, it's in terms of a protector, it's when we do have good friends, it's I think I was reading something of Bhikkhu Bodhi's that he was talking about about this quality, and he said it's actually as a reflection is if we do have good friends, it's like reflecting on yourself, it's like, are you the type of person that not necessarily deserves to have good friends, but you know, are you creating qualities in yourself that you're drawing people to you? Are you drawing good people to you? Are you doing things that will endure people to you? Are you, you know, gentle in your speech? Are you kind? Do you look after other people? You know, if you have responsibilities and duties, you know, do you do them? Do you do them well? Or are you the kind of person that's, you know, short and, you know, careless around things? And, you know, so it's like, you know, if we have good friends, it's usually a sign that we are living skillfully and we are living in a good way. And, you know, so not, you know, just the fact that you have good friends is a reflection that, you know, you do take care of yourself, that you do things properly. And just even in that quality in and of itself, just how reflecting about yourself, that becomes a protection. So it's like, so if you are doing, you know, thinking things through and following through on duties and responsibilities, then that in and of itself is a protection. And then I think having the good friends is kind of a manifestation of that, or kind of proof of that. Then the fourth quality is it's easy to correct someone who's easy to speak to. So if you do something that's incorrect or not so beautiful, you know, are you the type of person who, when someone brings that up to you, are you the type of person that defends yourself? Are you the type of person that, you know, has to, you know, wants to explain why you did it that particular way? It's interesting, like in society, that if someone's, you know, pointing out something to us that's, say, you know, is blameworthy, or, you know, something that we do need some guidance or correction, you know, in society, it's like, if you kind of talk back to that kind of person, that is kind of blameworthy. But if someone's giving you feedback and they're actually incorrect, like, you know, they've misperceived the situation, or just didn't have all the right facts, or just, you know, just wrong, you know, and they're criticizing you or pointing out something that you didn't do, you know, and again, in society, it's like, it's very, you know, not blameworthy at all to sort of correct that person and say, well, you know, you're off base, you know, I didn't do that, or, you know, to explain the situation. Most people would consider that not necessarily a fault. But I've actually seen several instances where somebody has been, you know, falsely accused of something, not necessarily nothing big or anything like that, but just, you know, like, yeah, when you did that, that was, you know, I was really disappointed. And the person didn't defend themselves, didn't try to correct the other person. And at the time when it happened, I didn't know the whole story. And I was, you know, kind of impressed that the person didn't, you know, defend themselves. That's always, it shows a sign of maturity when someone can just take advice from somebody or criticism and not get upset. So I was kind of impressed by this person. And then I mentioned that one time when it happened here, I mentioned it to another monk, and they said, yeah, that was really powerful, because actually the monk didn't do that. You know, the person, you know, misperceived it, and that monk didn't actually do it. And say my admiration for that monk just really increased, because it's like, yeah, he didn't have to be seen by anybody as being perfect or being right. And so in that sense, it's like, you know, another, you know, you can see the ego isn't involved if someone is easy to admonish, or someone who's willing to listen. And so when we can get out of that, you know, defending ourselves, or, you know, always wanting to be right, that's a real protection. I think there's also, like, when someone's trying to, you know, give us some feedback and we get really defensive, you can really see that strong sense of self and that real strong sense of clinging to, you know, to being right. So when you don't, when it can be, you know, if it's a training to actually, because it does, even if you are, you know, being even told something that's true, like, you know, okay, I do this, and that is maybe not so beautiful, and someone's telling it to you, you know, there can be this sort of sense of, you know, shame or regret, or just feels uncomfortable. So just learning to be okay with that uncomfortableness, and then when you can do that, then the protection's there in one sense, in that you know, people are willing to help you. And I think also too is like when someone criticizes, I think we all tend to take ourselves too seriously. So, like, we're always too worried about what other people think about us. But I think in reality, it's like, really, people don't care about us that much. Not in a uncompassionate way, but I think, like, what we worry about what other people think, I don't think people think those things hardly at all. You know, it's like, basically, it's, You know, it's like they just want the dishes washed. You know, they don't care what your story is behind why you don't want to do the dishes. They just want the dishes washed. If you just washed the dishes and got out, then there wouldn't be any issues. And so we create all this turmoil and stickiness to our lives because we get caught in the story. So if we can learn just to be, just easy to admonish, it just, there's a protection in that. And so the fifth one is, which I found was an interesting one too, very related to this, is that, say, a monk is skilled in attending to the duties that they have towards their fellow monastics. And so, like, if someone, like all of us here have duties, related to the monastery, every single one of us has some sort of aspect that we train in or that we're responsible for. And so just the that ability to set aside what I want to do for what's better for the group, what's better for the whole, that just developing that quality, that attentiveness. In one way, it's like a monk who is, or any community member who is, goes out of their way to to help people or to see, just to train themselves to be able to see what the needs are in the community. A monk like that, it's or any community member, it's people are much more willing to help that kind of person. So, like, there's the story where the Buddha is going on checking the monastery, and he comes across a monk who's sick, and no one's taking care of him, and he's kind of soiled in his own clothing, and probably the place smells, and then the Buddha gets his attendant Ananda, and they tend to the monk and change his clothing, and then he calls all the Sangha together and asks if anyone's taking care of them, and they say, well, that monk doesn't take care of anybody else. He doesn't do any duties or doesn't take care of anybody else, so we don't take care of him. And the Buddha admonishes this as not a beautiful quality, and then and sort of instructs the monks that we have to take care of each other. When I read that story, it's like, but if that monk had been taking care of other people, if he had been attentive to his duties and doing things that he was asked, or just even paying attention to other monks, he wouldn't have gotten in that situation, that people would have been caring for him or making sure his needs were met. And so there's a real protection that comes from just develop, it's developing bonds with each other in the monastery. It's that generosity, taking care of each other. So when someone, just like this afternoon, it's like right now I'm getting ready for, like, I have like three or four teaching engagements just this week, and with Vinaya classes and a day long, and then I had a meeting all afternoon or tea time with Lumpur and Ajahn Yaniko. And so at the end of that, I had, like, say, 15 minutes to go and do everything else I had to do. And there were a couple things with the traveling that I had to contact with several people. And so I had my teacup, and I walked into the monk's room over here to go wash my cup. And as soon as I walked through the room, three monks raised their hand up to grab my glass almost immediately. Literally immediately, as I came in, three people offered to wash my glass. That actually brought almost tears to my eyes, this real joy that, people are attentive and realize that maybe they didn't realize, they just did it anyway, but maybe there's a sense of, he's a senior monk and he's got duties, and if I can just help out in a little way, they give him a little bit more time to do those things. It makes me raise my game. So, like, if I see people are taking care of me that way, and then it's like, well, when I do work monk duties, or when I'm teaching, or when I'm doing things, it makes me that much more attentive to make sure I'm being attentive, to make sure I'm doing the best that I can. Because if other people are doing that for me, then that's just common courtesy. But also too, it's like, I'll remember those people. Like, there are certain people that aren't attentive to those kinds of things, and it's not that you tend to be mean or not so attentive to them, but it's like when people are really kind to you, there's just this natural response of, well, I'm going to try to help that person out as much as I can as well. And so you're developing that bond with that person, and then that becomes a protection. So the sixth one is love's the Dhamma and Vinaya, a love for that And Bhikkhu Bodhi's footnote to that was it's more like listening. He called it like attentively paying attention to when people are giving instructions, in terms of anything in the monastery, sort of work instructions or instructions in the kitchen, and but particular with say Dhamma talks and Vinaya, which I think that really kind of ties into the second one of the person is learned, remembers what they've heard. So with this real sense of eagerness to actually hear the teachings and to want to know how would the Buddha have approached the situation of near death, on a mountain instead of the guidebook. So there's this interest in listening. Then the seventh one is energy, and so it's applying effort. Lumpur talked a lot about this, but sort of abandoning the unwholesome qualities that we have, putting forth that effort. It's not necessarily to, the effort to cut off, like we have a negative trait about us that you're just trying to suppress it and cut it off, but it's putting forth the effort to understand, why do I do this here? How does that manifest? How does it, feel in my body when I'm in this particular mind state, or when I have this attitude? Like, what's happening in the physical body? Is it in my tense? Is it am I wasting a lot of physical energy with holding my body in a particular way, or what attitudes come out from that? How does that again, going back to having good friends and being attentive, is like is it preventing that? If I'm really tense and irritated, does that prevent me from really fulfilling the intentions that I have of being a good community member, being a good meditator? So putting forth effort into understanding that, and then conversely, then putting effort into skillful qualities that either we do have, so the Buddha would say, sort of maintaining those and bringing them to fruition, or if we don't have those qualities, understanding what those qualities are, contemplating how what you would need to do to have those qualities, and then putting forth the effort into trying to develop those. The eighth quality, which again falls in perfectly with the Metta Sutta, is contentment. There's a real protection in being contented. So, like, if you don't want anything, you don't need any. You don't. There's just that craving and desire just isn't there, and there's a real protection in that. In this context, the Buddha is talking about just being content with the four requisites. So, our robes, the alms food, lodgings, and medicines. But can extend over into discontentment with the situation in the monastery, our relationships with people, or again with our duties and responsibilities. So, but just working at that, learning to be content, ties in a lot with, say, renunciation and qualities like that. So the ninth one is mindfulness. So developing mindfulness, we can obviously see the protection in that. Just the more that we're aware of situations and bringing in, through mindfulness, being able to bring in the teachings that we need to be able to get through a particular situation. So I won't go into any detail with these last two, but say mindfulness, and the last one is wisdom. And say both of those are right in the Metta Sutta as well. So those are the 10 qualities that the Buddha really suggested for a protection. And then, say, just kind of in conclusion, sort of we were last night kind of talking about this, seeing being up on the ridge, and having all that fear, and Metta in particular was asking, like, well, she was really intrigued by that moment, like when I realized that the other two routes that I was thinking of taking and not having a map and not sure where they were, and thinking those two areas were scarier. She's like, well, what was it that actually sort of made you move? What was it that allowed you to step into the unknown, the uncertainty? And one thing that sort of came up for me was that, I think in that particular situation, I think maybe 20 years ago when I was younger and did a lot of hiking and stuff like that, just that amount of fear that I actually had when I was on that really steep section could have actually led to a bad situation. I think I could have actually made some really bad decisions and just really been set in my mind, like, I am not going down that route. And then that setting that particular fixed view into motion, you know, could have resulted in, you know, because you do hear stories of, you know, hikers going off trail and getting lost, or, you know, falling and or their sandals breaking, and, you know, some little thing happens that they hadn't planned on, and, you know, tragedy, you know, injury or even death, you know, could happen. But there was this, I wouldn't say necessarily a confidence, but it was, I actually realized in the situation that, I think I did tell this to Lumpur when I came back, it was like, especially when I was at the very top of the chute, or, you know, as I was going along, the mind occasionally would start throwing up these really horrific sort of scenarios in my mind. And when I started hiking down, it's like, I have really bad ankles, and so it was kind of stupid that I was wearing sandals up there. But, you know, I had this image of sort of, as I started hiking or climbing down, that, you know, like I'd be just putting my foot resting on a rock for protection, and then all of a sudden the ankle would twist and then, you know, fall over, and then I could see myself sort of start tumbling down the hill. But almost immediately when these proliferations would kick in, you know, my mind would just immediately stop and say, and how is this helping the situation? You know, it's like that was the wisdom part of the, you know, the mind coming in. It was like there's mindfulness sort of keeping track of where the mind was going. But then as soon as these destructive thoughts would come in, it was almost immediate. I could cut them off. And what I was describing last night was that, you know, when the mind does get into that kind of state of the adrenaline, you know, and the heart is racing and things, that it takes a lot of actually mindfulness at that point to really, you know, come into the situation. And this is the same here. It's like if you're in a situation, you know, during the work scene, be it out in the field or in the kitchen, or, you know, get a different, really strong, different opinion with somebody, or, you know, someone's being rude or something, you know, you can, when you start feeling that heart rate go up and you start feeling the blood pressure going, or the kind of heat in the face or in the body, like at that point, it's like we're being just flooded with the, you know, hormones and all sorts of, you know, these emotional, you know, chemicals in our body. And I've heard it takes like up to about a half hour at that point when those things start flooding the body for them to subside. And as long as they're there, though, for that like half hour period, just that agitation and the, you know, a lot of energy in the body, for me, like that's when the stories, the proliferations, when these images that were not very helpful in my mind, you know, that's the time when those start to flood in. So it's like when you know you're in that situation, it's just really important to focus on mindfulness, just really watching as close as you can, moment by moment, what mind states are popping up. And so in this situation, that's actually what I took refuge in. And I actually was very conscious of that. It's like, okay, yeah, I do have to hike down this really scary chute. And I actually knew that, you know, yeah, you might actually die here. And I was, it was like, that's okay. You're going to have to die sometime. So, yeah. But there was, you know, they didn't want that to happen. And there was every effort not to let that happen. But I realized, like, you know, the real one tool that's going to help in the situation was mindfulness and wisdom. And so just being able to, just as soon as anything that was happening that was detrimental to that, just note it and let it go, and then come right back. And also in helping doing that was the breath. So I was very, very conscious of, even though the heart was racing and I knew those chemicals were there, there was the ability to just using the breath to calm that energy down. And you know, so those chemicals were still there, but then that really did help not to allow those stories to come back in. And so, you know, just encouragement for here, the same, you know, same situation, not that it's a fear of death or anything like that, but like when we do find ourselves, you know, with real strong emotions, to, you know, just to remember that, the, you know, mindfulness of mind states, to use wisdom to see if it's skillful or unskillful, and then to, you know, to use the breath to, you know, to calm the body senses, and then to just come back to normality. But keeping on it until those emotions have subsided. So I'll end with saying, I can't wait for Yosemite next year. Yay. So that'll conclude there. Zah.